my world. Won't you come on in?
Yeah, come on in here. This is Terrible Tommy back in the saddle again. Sorry I missed you yesterday, but I'm back. Yeah, and it is the 4th of July, 2017. I wonder what's significant about that date. Do you know? Well, I guess that's one of the days when the white boys marched off to kill other white boys again. A fratricidal war, no matter how much we romance it, it was a fratricidal war, and primarily rich men against rich men. If you know anything about the people who were involved in the Founding Fathers, they were not poor men. And they didn't take a Democratic vote with the population because they would have lost, because most of the people in the colonies didn't want to go to war and didn't want to separate from England. And at the time, looking back, from my point of view, it probably was a bad idea. But later on, of course, that's a different story. Especially since no quicker than the ink was dry on the Constitution, Washington was prepared and did march out to western Pennsylvania, or was it eastern Pennsylvania, prepared to kill a bunch of farmers who declared they wanted to make their own booze because their crops had failed and everything else, and the New York distilleries run by the Jews had asked Washington to go out there and stop those guys from brewing their own whiskey. Yeah, so he and I think Jefferson too rode out on horses, took the troops out there. Had a happy ending though, because it came on winter and the troops bivouacked in the area where they were going to have their little war or suppression. And the troops spent so much scrip into circulation money that the farmers were able to recoup their losses, and so that in the spring there wasn't any reason to fight. That's an interesting story if you've ever heard about it. That was one of the first near rebellions that took place after the Constitution was signed. And to be truthful about it, I doubt whether the King of England would have given a shit whether the farmers were brewing that whiskey. Yeah. If you hear any strange noises in the background, we got a big 4th of July parade that's going on about a block from my place. So there's hundreds and hundreds of people parading and bands playing and jets flying overhead and you name it. I was going to start reading from a book I've had in my library for a long time called Letters from the Front. And these were letters from the troops in the First World War from the trenches of Europe. But I've decided to put that off and read from another small pamphlet I've got, which lets you know that even back in the 30s and 40s, there were maybe fake news, maybe not. So here we go. The Franklin D. Roosevelt death, a super mystery. Suicide, assassination, natural death, still alive. All those questions came up. Mystery doubled. The above facts were sufficient to start Washington tongues wagging and even to inspire concern in many quarters, both in the pro-Roosevelt and in the anti-Roosevelt camps. Lifetime political henchmen of the ambitious four-term president were mystified and dumbfounded, chagrined, even openly embarrassed over the way the matter was handled. Some were very outspoken. Little could be done about it, however, because long since the American people have discovered that protest, indignation, and shock had little effect on the White House affairs. Sound familiar? It remained, however, for Joe Stalin, close friend of Franklin D. Roosevelt, to lock the door to the mystery with a double lock. Those of us close to the Washington scene who knew much of what was going on inside knew beyond the peradventure of a doubt that Stalin had been very influential in the White House, but little did we realize that he would be the one to make the passing of his political pal a deeper mystery even than domestic circumstances might warrant. Upon being informed of the death of Franklin D. Roosevelt, Stalin immediately contacted in person the man who was ambassador to the United States, Andrei Gromyko. He instructed Gromyko to go personally to the White House, insist that the casket be opened, and report to him definitely whether or not he was convinced that Franklin D. Roosevelt was dead. Gromyko obeyed orders as far as possible, but was soon brought to a shocking halt. He discovered that even the ambassador from one of the four most powerful nations on earth would not be permitted to yield the remains. Here's how he discovered it. He made a formal call on the man who was then Secretary of State, Edward Stanetis. He expressed Stalin's wishes to Stanetis. He evidently conveyed to Stanetis that there was some doubt in the Russian dictator's mind about the death of America's fourth-term president. Stanetis assumed that he had a simple mission to perform. Of course, the White House would grant this simple request. He would have no difficulty in satisfying Stalin's concern or doubt of curiosity, as the case might be. There they go. Pardon me, boys. Some were very outspoken. Little could be done about it, however, because long since the American people had discovered that protest and indignation shock had little effect on White House affairs. It remained, however, for Joe Stalin, close friend of Franklin D. Roosevelt, to lock the door to the mystery with a double lock. Those of us close to Washington scene, who knew much of what was going on inside, knew beyond the peradventure of a doubt that Stalin had been very influential in the White House. But little did we realize that he would be the one to make the passing of his political pal a deeper mystery even than domestic circumstances might warrant. Upon being informed of the death of Franklin D. Roosevelt, Stalin immediately contacted in person the man who was the ambassador of the United States, Andrei Gromyko. He instructed Gromyko to go personally to the White House, insist that the casket be opened, and report to him definitely whether or not he was convinced that Franklin D. Roosevelt was dead. I know I read this before. Gromyko obeyed orders as far as possible, but was soon brought to a shocking halt. He discovered that even an ambassador from one of the four most powerful nations on earth would not be permitted to view the remains. Here's how he discovered it. He made a formal call on the man who was then our Secretary of State, Edward Stettinus. He expressed Stalin's wishes to Stettinus. He evidently conveyed to Stettinus that there was some doubt in the Russian dictator's mind about the death of America's fourth-term president. Stettinus assumed that he had a simple mission to perform. Of course, the White House would grant this simple request. He would have no difficulty in satisfying Stalin's concern or curiosity, as the case might be. The white-haired diplomat, who later was to be unsuccessful in an attempt to consummate the Roosevelt plan for world government, walked briskly to the White House and contacted the one in authority, who in this instance happened to be not the widow, not the private secretary, not the children, but Samuel Rosenman, whom the late president frequently referred to as Sammy the Rose. It is an open secret that Sammy the Rose wrote most of FDR's important speeches. especially those referring to our relationship with Germany, our international political strategy, and domestic measures having to do with the establishment of new and unheard of bureaus. The White House vetoed Stennis, they vetoed Gromyko, and they vetoed Stalin. Why did Stalin want to know? Why was he suspicious? Why did he doubt the widow and family, the newspapers, and the palace guard? When the report was flashed over the wire, Franklin D. Roosevelt is dead. Experienced and keen observers in Washington believe to this day that all the arguments that might be brought forth cannot remove their conviction that Stalin still had doubts. Why was he so anxious to know? Here is the answer. Roosevelt had conferred with Stalin in person to the knowledge of the world two times, once at Tehran and once at Yalta. These personal conferences cost the United States literally millions of dollars. When the president journeyed to the meeting place, he was accompanied by dreadnoughts, bombers, anti-aircraft equipment, thousands of troops, and an unbelievable number of naval personnel. Before the arrival of Roosevelt and Stalin, every house in the community where the meeting was held was searched. Every person under suspicion was either imprisoned or isolated. Stalin didn't trust the Americans to prepare his food, and the Americans didn't trust the Russians to prepare their food. Both Roosevelt and Stalin took their own food tasters, food samplers, who examined the food, tasted the food, and served the food. The conferences were surrounded with utmost secrecy, the type of secrecy which violates all the traditions of a free republic. Both men conducted themselves as dictators. One was a dictator and admitted it. The other was a dictator and denied it. Many of us believed at the time, and it is now leaking out as an established fact, namely that Roosevelt agreed to every demand made by Stalin. These commitments will be dismissed later in this manuscript or discussed. He promised Stalin practically everything he desired, the lion's share of China, a chance at India, Hitler's booty in Europe. He promised to let the Communist Party in America alone. He promised to make the issue of red propaganda in the United States, make no issue of it. In olden times, especially in the Asiatic and semi-Asiatic countries, it was the custom of dictators, kings, rulers, and military overlords to meet and strike agreements concerning matters involving the nations they represented. Occasionally, a ruler, in his anxiety to strike a good bargain, would make impossible promises, then after he returned to his country, disappear. Upon disappearing, his palace guard would report to the world that he was dead. In this way, the country enjoyed the assets of the agreement without having to fulfill all the liabilities. Although Stalin claimed to be a friend of Roosevelt, and although Roosevelt promised and carried out practically everything that Stalin desired up to the hour of his death, Stalin must have known that Roosevelt was a smooth, slick operator. Surely there must have been times when Roosevelt's promises to him seemed too good to be true. He must have known, as many of us knew, that FDR was one of the most convincing promisers the political world had ever known, whether he intended to carry out his promises or not. Among the notorious promises of FDR, the super demagogue of all times, were the following. During his 1940 campaign for president, Mr. Roosevelt knew that the American people didn't want war, just like Woodrow Wilson. In this Boston speech of 1940, he said, I say to you, fathers and mothers, again and again and again, your sons shall not be sent to fight and die on foreign soil. In his Philadelphia speech, just prior to the Boston appearance, he had added the words, unless attacked. This had aroused great suspicion among people who assumed that an attack would be participated as an alibi. In the meantime, Wilkie was promising no war under any circumstances. Therefore, in order to outbid Wall Street's one worlder, FDR raised the ante in Boston and omitted the words unless attacked. In his 1932 campaign, Mr. Roosevelt deplored the extravagance and spending policies of the Hoover administration and assured the nation that he would reduce the spending budget 25%. During his terms of office, not counting war costs, the New Deal president spent more money than all the presidents of the United States up until his own term combined. Now you see what I think of politicians? I hope you understand. Stalin was afraid of just exactly what has happened, namely that the United States without dictator Roosevelt would not do as much for him as would be done his political pal remained alive. Knowing the fox-like temperament of the Hyde Park squire, the Soviet dictator was anxious to make sure that the palace guard or some powerful group had not spirited their spokesman away on the ground that at last he had made some promises that could not be fulfilled or evaded. Stalin is still in doubt. He is still suspicious. No statement from the White House, no report from the Palace Guard, no public expression from the Roosevelt family has ever been made concerning the denial of Stalin's request. If the Roosevelt family and their political coordinates were of a modest and retiring nature, this might be understood as being merely a natural display of modesty. But the Roosevelt family talks about everything. Nothing seems to be sacred as far as domestic problems are concerned. Divorce scandals, profiteering scandals, money-making enterprises indulged in by Eleanor Roosevelt and the children seem to cause them no anxiety or chagrin. Eleanor Roosevelt, in her column, has discussed everything from the mating dates of household dogs on up to how much an American girl should drink. She has advocated the intimate and social admixture between black and white, race mixing. She has entertained, and she had a boyfriend, a nigger boyfriend down in Harlem too, I'll inject that. She has entertained communists in the White House. She has addressed, encouraged, and inspired practically every left-wing pro-Stalin, pro-communist organization in the United States. The Roosevelt sons have indulged in all the more crude forms of conduct necessary to establish themselves as brazen extroverts. Franklin Jr., while in Paris, squirted champagne in a diplomat's face. Elliot obtained air passage priority in time of war for a dog belonging to his second wife, an actress, at a time when it was necessary to leave military personnel stranded in order to take care of this dog belonging to the wife of the prince. In the midst of a blare of trumpets, the Roosevelt daughter, Anna, divorced the father of her children and remarried. The antics of the elder son are too numerous to mention. As a manipulator of high finance, he has been more successful than his brother Elliot, although neither ever missed an opportunity to use their father's power to turn a good deal for themselves. Nothing changes, boys and girls, T.T. says. Along with everything else, Franklin Jr., who would like to step into his father's boots, married a DuPont. John, the youngest son, has been the most retiring member of the family. John Roosevelt's secret is little known. While the president and his wife, Eleanor, were shouting for war, their youngest son was a conscientious objector. He believed that the war was unnecessary, that it could have been avoided. Well, all wars can be avoided. And that it was participated by lovers of war. He refused first to enlist and to serve in any military capacity whatsoever. Finally, under pressure from his mother, he accepted a military post in the South Seas with the understanding that at no time would it be necessary for him to take a life or engage in combat. This conduct on the part of the youngest Roosevelt was pretty well covered up, and to this very day, not one person out of 10,000 knows the story. There is much more to tell, but space here does not permit. Thus, even a superficial survey of the conduct of the Roosevelt family should convince any person with ordinary intelligence that Roosevelts are not modest, retiring, or timid. The casket was left closed because somebody had something to hide. What it was, we may never know exactly, but some of us have some well-founded suspicions. Following the death of the president, it has been announced that the Roosevelt papers, the Roosevelt letters, in fact, all the Roosevelt correspondence would be sent to Hyde Park, but it wasn't that simple. Sammy the Rose assumed complete authority over the files and went through them letter by letter, paper by paper, pencil note by pencil note, and removed everything that, in his opinion, the public should never see. Were these papers destroyed? If so, who destroyed them? If not, where are they? Who was given authority over the official correspondence of a man who was our president? Why should this ghostwriter have ever been given authority to delete the official files of the President of the United States? Well, you see how they're doing that now with the Obama papers? They shuttled everything off, including a whole lot of other security information, to Obama's library in Chicago. And they're putting it under lock and key. What is being hidden from the American people? Much, 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 too much. Not only is much being hidden now, but much was hidden prior to his death. Admiral Ross McIntyre was Roosevelt's personal physician. This admiral was perhaps the most artful, convincing, and unscrupulous falsifier and prevaricator ever to appear on the public scene. Invariably, he reported to the nation that his master was in perfect health. In 1944, when the political manipulators aided by Wallace, Frankfurter, and Rosenman wanted the Democratic Party to nominate Roosevelt for a fourth term, the American people wanted to know if he was physically fit. Up came the willing admiral with a so-called scientific report to the effect that the president was in sound health, in excellent condition. In general, rumors persisted that he was a dying man at the time of the Chicago Democratic Convention. Roosevelt, theoretically, was not president. He was supposed to be investigating war equipment and defense materials across the nation. But now it is a matter of knowledge that he went to Chicago secreted in the presidential car on the railroad tracks in the suburbs, and there manipulated and pulled the wires of the convention. It was on this occasion that he uttered the much-publicized statement concerning the choice of vice president. Clear it with Sidney. That was the Jew. Here's a footnote. Sidney referred to Sidney Hillman, who was then the president of the Amalgamated Clothing Workers of the CIO and national head of the Political Action Committee. Hillman was originally educated in Russia to be a rabbi. He deserted the Jewish clergy to become a communist organizer. He was exiled for revolutionary activities and fled as a refugee to the United States. He spoke with a thick Yiddish accent, and expert observers believe that he never became oriented to American tradition. He cooperated in one way or another with all the left-wing organizations in America, including the Communist Party. Now, do you see anything different today with the Great White Hope or any of the presidents? They fill the White House with Jews. Obama made a mistake of putting too many Negroes in there. The nurse was not... Let's see, where am I missing something here? Clear it with Sydney. Whoops! I'm missing a page. Damn, I'm going to have to turn this place upside down. Because this thing is all yellow sheet. The sheet is yellow and falling apart. I have to remember to put these things in plastic bags because I've got so many of these old manuscripts. The nurse was not present, reading on to page 14. No member of the family was in Warm Springs. There was no eyewitness to his death as far as public conventional information is concerned. It is alleged that he was alone at least 2 hours. Some say that these 2 hours of solitude took place in the little White House. Others say that he drove into the mountains and there requested that he be left absolutely alone. Those who hold to suicide theory insist that he withdrew from the Secret Service men, his servants, and his associates, put a pistol to his head, and pulled the trigger. The writer knows some people whose judgment he respects who are not satisfied with the accounting that has been given of the movements and the conduct and the motives of the Russian artist. The story of the Russian artist is yet to be told. Time and space do not permit that, even speculations, to be reviewed in this manuscript. Those who hold to the murder theory insist that Roosevelt was a tool of a terrible international cabal. Yeah, the Jews. They felt that he had fulfilled his purpose. They knew he was in bad health and they feared that he might make some horrible blunder growing out of delirium or senility that might expose his hand, spoiled years of successful satanic plotting. All through history, it has been the custom of international conspirators to either murder their tools or condition them by power of suggestion to suicide. This reminds me of the story about President Johnson, that in his last days he was in delirium, admitting his involvement in the JFK assassination and so forth. I have that material someplace. Footnote: the death of Roosevelt took place 1 week after he was quoted as saying, "I learned more about Palestine in 5 minutes from Ibn Saud, ruler of the Arabs, than I had known in my entire life previously." Since Roosevelt's death, Ibn Saud has been quoted as saying, "He, Roosevelt, assured me that Palestine would never be taken away from the Arabs." Did Franklin D. Roosevelt commit suicide? Did he draw a weapon on himself which so defaced him or marred his physiognomy that his family and the White House authorities dared not permit him to lie in state for public view? There sat Franklin D. Roosevelt, the man, broken in health, with more world secrets on his mind than any living creature, with the possible exception of a certain unnamed international politicians who, like their predecessors in centuries past, have played the ambitious politicians like chessmen in a dreadful game of power and authority. These international manipulators have no regard for the comfort and welfare of the human race, much less the white race. They start and stop wars, they create panics, they promote booms, they pour blood of millions on the ground. Gee, sounds like today's newspaper. They reduce human beings to slavery, bondage, without concern. They are the most powerful men on earth. They are the international bankers, the Rothschilds, the Warburgs, the Sassoons, the Morgans, the Normans, the Schiffs, the Kuhns, and the Loebs. No, they wouldn't do that. Those of us whose opinions are not formed by superficial radio comment or newspaper headlines believe that Roosevelt occupied a paradoxical position in the international cabal. He played the role of both tool and master, and fulfilled his responsibility in the role of a saint with the motives of a sinner. Motives for suicide. The world may never know whether or not Franklin D. Roosevelt committed suicide. There is much, however, to support this theory. He loved power. His appetite for power was insatiable. He longed to dominate Congress completely. Well, what president hasn't done that? They're all paranoid schizophrenics. He grew fat during the days when he had what was commonly known as a rubber stamp, Congress. He relished the opportunity to manipulate and spend and even squander billions and billions of dollars. He glowed with pride and vanity at the thought of seeing bankers, governors, manufacturers, senators, and leading businessmen come to the White House for a government grant necessary to rescue them from an economic condition which his program of regimentation had helped to create. The war came at a time when the falsity of his claims for the New Deal was beginning to be evident. Only war could save him. Only war could give him the master whip to crack over the heads of Congress rapidly and become belligerent. Only a war could absorb the men that were becoming unemployed. Only a war could give full employment where the New Deal had failed in its promise to give full employment. Franklin Roosevelt, the country squire, who had never earned a living outside of politics, had a lot on his mind. His conscience was tortured by his weakening body. He was not longer in a condition to throw off the dreaded thoughts that haunted him. He had come to the end of the road where he was compelled to look his conscience and his past in the face. He had helped to set the whole world on fire. There was nothing left to ignite. No emergency could be created to deflect the attention of the people towards the inevitable chaos which he and others had helped create. If Franklin Roosevelt's mind was clear and rational when he sat in Warm Springs, Georgia in April 45, he knew that he was about to be overtaken by his conscience, by the peoples of the world, by his own fellow citizens, and by public sentiment in general. He loved nothing as much as praise, glory, and power. He knew that the discovery of the truth by the public in general would rob him of everything he held dear. From a materialistic standpoint, he had nothing for which to live. He may have died from shock. The possibility of assassination is remote. He could have committed suicide, and even though he died a natural death brought on by physical deterioration, it is easy to believe that even his physical deterioration was brought about by a circumstance which cornered the man and forced him to face repudiation in the eyes of the world because he could no longer divert the attention of the people by a promise, a glib speech, a new emergency, or a world catastrophe. There was no more money to spend, no blood to spill, no promises to make. The end had come. The sunless mothers, the bankrupt nations, the legless veterans, the battle dead, and the inevitable world chaos remain as the monuments and memorials to this man who wanted to rule the world and failed. 9 ghosts that haunted FDR. Ghost number 1, Tyler Kent. And Tyler Kent, I have that book by Tyler Kent too. Among well-informed students of contemporary history, there is no doubt that Franklin D. Roosevelt desired and actually helped to bring about and promote World War II. This theory is supported by numerous events and numerous facts. Among the most sensational is the story of Tyler Kent, the young code clerk who worked in the American Embassy in London. Young Kent came from an old-time Virginia family. His father and mother were career diplomats, having served the State Department of the United States government for years. When Kent came to maturity, he proved to be almost a genius in translating, speaking, and interpreting foreign languages. He followed his father's footsteps and entered the diplomatic service. He became a code clerk. At first he was at Moscow. He understood the Russian language so well that he could speak it without an accent. He disguised himself as a peasant and mingled among the Russian people. He discovered the deceptive nature of communism. He soon learned that the Soviet government was merely a tyrannical political machine, crushing 180 million people into slavery. The Russians became suspicious of Kent, and because of this suspicion, he became persona non grata in Moscow. He was transferred from Moscow to London. He was followed to London by his Russian secret police. Here he was charged with responsibility of interpreting and translating code messages sent to the United States to England. Late in 38 and in 39, young Kent began to see messages from President Roosevelt that alarmed him. He began to translate these messages for Winston Churchill and others, only to discover there was a definite program on the part of Roosevelt to get us into the war. At that time, Mr. Chamberlain was Prime Minister. According to the cablegrams, Roosevelt wanted Chamberlain ousted. Winston Churchill, in his cable messages to Roosevelt, is alleged to have said, quote, "You and I can rule the world," unquote. Something like 1,500 messages were exchanged under the shocked eyes of this young American, Kent. He felt within his heart that treason was being committed, that a great people was being betrayed. When the messages first began to be exchanged, Churchill was not the Prime Minister. In fact, he had no right to these messages. Kent was forced to decide between his technical duty and his patriotic duty. He chose the latter. He copied these messages and took them to his apartment. He did not know that he was being followed by the Russian secret police. It is believed by informed and shrewd observers that the Russians copied these messages and sent them to Joseph Stalin, who even to this day has them securely locked in a Kremlin safe. It is believed that he made it known to Mr. Roosevelt that he had copies of these messages and used this fact to bludgeon over the head of the ambitious president. Kent had hoped to get copies of these messages out of England in order that he might bring a report to such men as United States Senator Burton K. Wheeler, United States Senator Gerald P. Nye, and other courageous men that were ready to expose the truth to the nation. Kent was unsuccessful. Roosevelt ordered that he be fired. Later, he was picked up on the street by British secret police and sentenced to 7 years in a concentration camp on the Isle of Wight. His trial was secret, and he was given little opportunity to defend himself. Gradually, the truth concerning this young man began to leak out in the United States. He was kept in this concentration camp for 5 years. A few months ago, he was returned to the United States. It was hoped that he would tell all. However, shortly after he arrived, he was reminded indirectly by a representative of the State Department that if he told what he knew, he would be sentenced under a new law to 10 years in prison. It is believed that this new law was forced through purposely by FDR in order to prevent the truth from ever coming out concerning the secret cable messages between Roosevelt and his British co-conspirators. How do you like all this, boys and girls? It's the way governments run. They're never any different. That's why you can't trust government. You must trust yourself. Kent is now in the United States. He is watched day and night. His life is not safe. Locked in his mind is one of the big secrets of all time. He was the one who read the cablegrams between Franklin D. Roosevelt and certain British politicians who desired, planned, and plotted this war. There's only one way we can get the truth out of Kent's mind without his being sentenced to 10 years in prison. Namely, if a congressional committee will subpoena Kent, put him under oath, and demand that he tell all, he can speak with immunity. It was hoped that the Pearl Harbor Investigating Committee or some other outstanding congressional committee might do this, but the leftover leadership of the Roosevelt administration shuddered at the thought. The international warmongers brought terrific pressure on the proper authorities, and Kent was not called. The ghost of the incident of Tyler Kent was one of the terrific things that haunted the sick man at Warm Springs. Ghost number two, the mystery of Pearl Harbor. The truth, the real truth, and the full truth concerning Pearl Harbor has never been brought out. The nearest that we can ever come to getting it was found in a series of articles written by the courageous journalist John T. Flynn. Mr. Flynn made himself a student of the Pearl Harbor scandal, and his articles, he identified the scoundrels of the world. Time and space do not permit us to discuss the Pearl Harbor scandal in detail in this manuscript. But those books are around, boys and girls. It was all put up job. When the full truth comes out concerning the attack at Pearl Harbor, it will require a full-size book to cover the subject. It is believed by those in the know here in Washington that Mr. Roosevelt had given up the idea of trying to get the United States into World War II based on anything that was taking place in Europe or on the high seas of the Atlantic. Before the Pearl Harbor incident, the anti-war sentiment was predominant in the United States. A poll of public opinion revealed that 81% of the people were against entering the war Roosevelt had promised war. Well, you see, they were fresh out of the First World War. Now here they are going into the Second World War. Same thing in Germany. He had told the French that if they entered the war, he would support them. That's like I told the Japanese when I was in Japan and addressing about 500 Japanese businessmen and military men. I said, don't ever trust the United States government. Trust the people, but don't trust the government. At one time, our then ambassador to France had asserted that the United States would be in the war in 9 days after France entered the war. Doubtless, Roosevelt had made commitments to the British authorities which he felt obligated to keep. On the Atlantic, he had virtually taken us into the war without the consent of Congress. He was on the toughest spot of any man in history. God only knows how many times he broke his oath and violated the law in order to arbitrarily participate in the war without an official declaration from Congress of the United States. He had to have an incident. He had to have what it took to produce hysteria in the United States. The attack on Pearl Harbor was the answer. The Pearl Harbor attack was not a surprise. Roosevelt expected it. Roosevelt desired it. Roosevelt participated it. Even Eleanor Roosevelt, in one of her columns articles, said, we were all expecting it. The reason Pearl Harbor investigation outside and rather limited report made for the minority by the United States Senator Ferguson of Michigan was little more than a whitewash. The minority could not even bring out the facts because the necessary files were locked to the minority on the committee. Two members of the committee, it is believed, were virtually blackmailed by political pressure into signing a report not in harmony with their deepest convictions. And incidentally, that information about the attack on Pearl Harbor had been transmitted by the Portuguese government. It was out there, and anybody in the know should have known. The weak, sick, burnout, exhausted, crippled man at Warm Springs was haunted by the ghost of Pearl Harbor. Whether or not he committed suicide, the fact remains that many men have committed suicide under less pressure. Ghost number three, the Japanese offer to surrender before Okinawa. Few people realize that the Japanese government offered to surrender completely, even as completely as they finally did surrender, before our attack on Okinawa. It seemed wise for us to accept their surrender. Conventional military procedure required that we accept their surrender. Got to remember that thousands and thousands of Japanese died on Okinawa, plus the American troops. but Roosevelt refused to accept it by saying that they have not suffered enough. That figures. These leaders are psychopaths. Every fucking one of them are psychopaths. His arbitrary determination to wreak vengeance on millions of innocent people who had nothing to do with starting the war cost in American lives wounded and killed alone more than 100,000. It is a known fact that the Battle of Okinawa was one of the bloodiest of all time. The boys killed on Okinawa and killed after Okinawa were sacrificed to the vanity of this man who desired to be head of the world empire and one world government. Ghost number four, the assassination of United States Senator Huey P. Long. When I was helping Duke out with his first campaign, we went to the state capitol there in Louisiana, and we went into the state building there that Huey Long built. It looked like a Berlin building. Looked like it was right out of Berlin. And I stood on the spot where Huey Long had been assassinated by a Jew dentist. Ghost number four. Few people realize that one of the greatest unsolved mysteries of this century is the assassination of Huey P. Long, who was Roosevelt's most effective opponent in the South. He was the first outstanding Democrat ever to oppose a Democrat president of the United States. Mr. Long became Mr. Roosevelt's obsession. Late in the summer of 1935, a dictaphone account was made recording the conversation of a group of plotters who met in room 506 of the DeSoto Hotel in New Orleans. They were leading New Deal politicians, Roosevelt's henchmen, and the most outstanding enemies of Huey P. Long. A few days after the conversation, Mr. Long arose on the floor of the United States Senate and reported the words of the plotters. One plotter said, quote, it will only take a gun, one man, and one bullet, unquote. Another plotter said, quote, if we kill Long in Washington, I can guarantee that the President Roosevelt will pardon the killer, unquote. It is still a mystery why they decided to have Long assassinated in Baton Rouge, the capital of Louisiana. Suffice it to say the plot was fulfilled, and on 8th of September 1935, Long was shot by a young Jewish doctor by the name of Carl Weiss. Weiss was killed on the spot by bodyguards. Long died 2 days later and was buried on September the 12th. 250,000 people attended the funeral. Floral tributes covered 2 acres surrounding the grave. Every informed individual in Washington knew that Roosevelt desired the death of Huey Long, and it is believed by many who have evidence to support their contentions that he cooperated with those who desired and participated in the assassination of the only man who really ever threatened Roosevelt's power. The ghost of Huey Long could easily have visited the emancipated Roosevelt as he sat in his wheelchair in Warm Springs. And you thought the Godfather of the Mafia was bad. In fact, the Godfather of the Mafia was much more honest than this son of a bitch, Roosevelt. Ghost number five, the appeasement of the Comintern. The cooperation of Franklin D. Roosevelt gave to the Communist International is almost beyond belief. As time went on, he began to desert his old friend Winston Churchill. He began increasingly pro-Stalin, pro-Russian, pro-Communist. Under pressure from Stalin, Roosevelt ordered that the Communists be commissioned in the United States Army. He ordered that the files on the activities of international Communist plotters be kept by the military and naval intelligence to be destroyed. Now, you see, they've got you thinking that Now you're taught to think how bad Senator Joseph McCarthy was. Joseph McCarthy was a patriot. Joseph McCarthy had the goods on these bastards. And even, it's come out even after that, that the Communists were all over our government. But now, what do you hear all the time? McCarthyite. and always attacking Joe McCarthy. They never attacked Kennedy, who was working on his staff, which is interesting. As time went on, he began to desert his old friend Winston Churchill. He became increasingly pro-Stalin. Well, I said that. Poor old Joe McCarthy gave his life for the country, no matter how many mistakes he made. He was right about the communists in the government. And definitely, they're still there, only call themselves Democrats. Let me see here. He tried unsuccessfully to get J. Edgar Hoover fired because Mr. Hoover has always been vigorously anti-communist. Well, I didn't think much of J. Edgar Hoover, but I'm sure he did some good. Through public pressure and support of the Congress of the United States, Hoover had been kept in his job. Fortunately, the government now has in Mr. Hoover's office the most complete file on red treason to be found anywhere in the world. If Roosevelt had his way, these files would have been destroyed. Thanks to President Truman, Mr. Hoover has been kept in authority and enjoys full cooperation on the Truman administration, which is obviously anti-communist. It will always be a mystery as to why Franklin D. Roosevelt became such a tool of international communism. You know, as far as that J. Edgar Hoover thing, maybe he was, I think he was the only leader of the FBI that was openly, or not openly, but a homosexual. So you got to give one homosexual some credit. One theory is that he was never able to make money independently in business. He developed an inferiority complex, which I think most leaders have. He became jealous of his old friends and neighbors who had become wealthy by their own right. He took a fiendish delight in seeing their opportunities impaired and destroyed. Another theory is that he was so vain that he would respond to anyone who would flatter and glorify his ego. Another theory is that he was so hungry for power that he was willing to trade off American tradition for the chance to become president of the world. Ghost 6, Lend-Lease, Felix Frankfurter, Jew, who always had an ear of President Roosevelt, was the one who wrote the actual Lend-Lease bill. His Lend-Lease bill was one of the most vicious betrayals of American people ever to take place. When Benedict Arnold sold the troops at West Point to the British government, he was a piker compared to those who forced through under the lash of Franklin D. Roosevelt the so-called Lend-Lease bill. It gave our president the authority to virtually exhaust our natural resources and give our wealth and donate our wealth to the nations of the world. Congress abdicated its authority and put into the hands of the President of the United States the power to donate billions of dollars to anyone, anywhere, arbitrarily, without confirmation, double check, or review. Well, they carried that right on with foreign aid. The foreign aid's still going on right now. Big amounts of money every year go to our enemies, especially to Israel. 3 or 4 million a year, more than that. Is it billion? I don't know. We give them jet planes, tanks, anything they want. Which pretty well proves the Jews are pretty much in control. I resist sometimes going on and on about the Jews because I know everybody else does. But there's plenty of hard evidence to show what they're doing, and you can't deny it. The passage of the Lend-Lease bill was the boldest, most brazen betrayal of the people's rights over to take place in connection with our economic life. Children of our grandchildren will be paying interest on the money which we were compelled to borrow in order to fulfill Mr. Roosevelt's vain ambitions to dominate the world through financial power. Well, that's nothing compared to what they're doing today. I mean, trillions of dollars in debt. the little nations and the great nations, understanding his power over this unaccountable sum of money, began to kowtow to him, and he began to demand political administration in these various nations satisfactory to himself. In other words, if you want the money, you'll have the government I want you to have. Those who knew Roosevelt believed that he expected to use lend-lease donations to corrupt and buy and control the governments of foreign countries, just as he had used relief and the PWA and bureaucratic appropriations to get control of congressmen, governors, and state administrations. As this sick man reflected in Warm Springs, Georgia, he must have known that he had saddled on the backs of the American people a debt much greater than necessary, a debt so great that millions of people someday would be reduced to virtual peonage if it were ever paid. Ghost number 7, bargaining and human slaves. When Roosevelt, hell was freeing the blacks, free everybody. What Roosevelt met with Stalin on foreign soil, he was not in the dark concerning the savage practices of this cruel dictator. He knew that Stalin was as powerful and as merciless as any half-savage ruler in all history. Not since the days of Genghis Khan, not since the days of barbarians of old, had any ruler crushed and killed and enslaved and tortured more human beings than Joseph Stalin. Today he stands as a champion crucifier, the champion of the Christ killer, the champion liquidator of all times. The Roosevelt was a well-informed man. He had access to sources of information which proved to him beyond the peradventure of a doubt that when he bargained with Stalin, he bargained with a savage killer. No one can ever convince this writer or any informed individual that Roosevelt's agreements with Stalin were innocent. Among those things which he agreed to do was to turn over to Stalin German citizens for human slaves. The estimated number that he offered to give Stalin ranges between 2 and 10 million. Now that the war is over, we see that the conduct of the Russian dictator, we can understand what these awful agreements meant. Millions of the cream of Germany's youth have been kidnapped and taken into bondage and human slavery. This has been done because of earlier agreements made between Stalin and Roosevelt. We know that Roosevelt hated the German people, even the millions of innocent ones who were in no way responsible for the rise in power of Hitler. And remember, Einstein met with Roosevelt on several occasions, urging him to build that bomb so they could drop it on Germany. I mean, this is the kind of people you're up against. These are the kind of kikes and Jews, and there are plenty of others that are just plain rats. As the declining Roosevelt sat in the Warm Springs, he must have pictured in his mind these millions of poor German people were reduced to Russian slavery. He must have known that he was jointly to blame for the inevitable. What a ghost to haunt such a hypocrite. Had he not posed as the great emancipator of the modern generation, had his wife not posed as the greatest friend the Negro had, had they not used their political power and political position to convince the poor and the wretched of the nation that theirs was the voice of the common man, what a haunt, what a ghastly specter to rise before this declining hypocrite. To realize within his own secret heart that while posing as a friend of the oppressed in America, he had agreed to the revival of medieval slavery in Eastern Europe and Russia. Let's see how many pages I got. I think I can finish this up. Ghost number 8, the destruction of food and commodities, planned scarcity in the face of world famine. No act in history of the human race ever exceeded the cruelty, lunacy, and folly, the orders that came out of the White House through Henry Wallace, the obedient servant of FDR, to destroy the nation's food supply, to destroy the nation's clothing supply. Overnight, millions of tons of cotton were destroyed. Millions of cowhides necessary for shoes were burned up. Millions of pounds of wool went into the flames. Sugar cane piled as high as houses was burned under the order of the Secretary of Agriculture. Millions of gallons of milk were poured on the ground. Over 1 million head of cattle were shot and buried in 1 month. Hogs were ground into fertilizer and spread out on the ground like dirt. Sows about to give birth with pigs were thrown into the river and drowned. The order had gone out from the White House to create an artificial scarcity to reduce the supply of abundance that God had given a great people in answer to their prayers. At the very time that this abundance was being destroyed, millions of people were starving all over the world. Later, America was to experience a shortage of every necessity. Meat was to be rationed. Food and commodities of all sorts would be rationed. A nation flowing with milk and honey was to find itself short of every necessity of life. Those who knew and understood the tricks of the bureaucratic tyrants in Washington knew Roosevelt and his henchmen wanted to create an artificial scarcity, then seize control of the food supply and clothing supply, to force a free people to file by some bureaucrat one at a time in order to obtain the right to purchase the necessities of life. This was Stalin's plan. This was the plan of regimentation for which the president longed. In other words, the whole nation was turned into niggers. Yeah. If one spark of rich American tradition is lingered in his heart at Warm Springs, he must have been haunted when he reviewed the ghastly facts concerning this awful plot. I don't think Roosevelt had a conscience at all. I don't think he would have committed suicide. I think he was son of a bitch who hopefully was assassinated. Ghost number 9, false promises concerning the possibility of war. Franklin D. Roosevelt knew that there would be a Second World War if he could possibly bring it about. He had been promising it to the French and to the Russians and to the British. He knew what he had been saying in the secret cablegrams to England, which had been copied by young covert clerk Tyler Kent. He knew what he was willing to do in the Pacific, and although he may not in 1940 have planned Pearl Harbor episode, he knew he was willing to participate in a Pearl Harbor in order to keep his promise to the war makers to get the United States into the war. He wanted war. He was willing to promote war. He later participated in war. Even so, with all these things in mind, he was willing to promise the mothers and fathers anything in order to get reelected the third term in 1940. In his speech in Philadelphia, he said, quote, "I say to you, fathers and mothers, again and again and again, your sons shall not be sent to die on foreign soil unless attacked." Public reaction rose against the last phrase. Many people believe that phrase, "unless attacked," was merely an alibi phrase that would be used later on as an excuse to prove that he had not violated his promise to the people. So when he went up to Boston to make his next speech, his political advisors insisted that he leave off that phrase. Therefore, in Boston, he made a complete unconditional promise in these words, quote, "I say to you, fathers and mothers, again and again and again, your sons shall not be sent to die on foreign soil." This promise was the most hypocritical promise ever made by a man in the history of the world. Others, of course, had been made hypocritical promises. Woodrow Wilson had been elected to the second term because he kept us out of war, although before his first term was ended, he knew that we were going to war. The thing that made Roosevelt's promise hypocritical was because he was the most powerful man on earth, and for him to be so powerful and know so completely that he wanted war and give this false encouragement to the mothers and fathers of the nation marked him as one of the most diabolical betrayers of confidence the human race has ever known. As he sat in Warm Springs, Georgia, he must have seen through his dying eyes a vision of the millions whose blood was spilled, perhaps unnecessarily, on the battlefields of Europe. Well, of course it was unnecessary. As we now measure the cost of World War I, the results of World War II, surely no sane person could believe that we had won the peace. We defeated Hitler and then handed the victory on a silver platter to Roosevelt's friend Joseph Stalin. Stalin dominates Europe. He dominates the Orient. He imperils the West and menaces civilization. He could not have risen to such power but for the help of the United States and Roosevelt. The United States would never have fattened this savage as it did had it not been for Franklin D. Roosevelt. If ghosts could tempt a man to suicide, if ghastly reminders of guilt could tempt a man to reach out for a fatal weapon or drink the deadly potion, then surely this man, Franklin D. Roosevelt, had all the temptations necessary to encourage him to retire from the scene in advance even of nature's call. Footnote: rumors from sources we consider reliable has it that Admiral McIntyre was heard to say that Roosevelt's body was not embalmed, that it turned black in less than 4 hours after death. Students of the embalming science insist that one of the few causes of such physical reaction on the part of dead bodies is arsenic poisoning. Of course, I say this may have been connected to his connection to Judaism. And, you know, a lot of people say that the Rosenfelds came out of Jewry and they have some weird burial rites, you know. Well, that's it, boys and girls. I don't know whether we have copied and reprinted this for the website or not. And I've got to look around and hopefully can find that one page that's missing. But this is extremely important information because all the young people around have never heard this stuff. I mean, you know, it's totally new to them, and they would think it's science fiction, probably. I'll be back with you tomorrow on, tomorrow is what? This is the 4th, I know that. Wednesday. I'll be back with you tomorrow. Wotan's Day. David Lane's favorite day. Another assassination victim of the United States criminals. These war criminals only know one thing: kill or be killed. I'll tell you, the people are going to have to defend themselves at some point, or they'll be enslaved forever.
We live. We fight. We die. Not for you. We live. We fight. And we die. For each other. Not for you.
Am I a hater? You're goddamn right I'm a hater. And I'll die a hater.